Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. As part of his new policy on Iraq, President Bush says that he will send an additional 21,000 soldiers to boost security in Baghdad. The president's planned troop surge has left a lot of people asking a very basic question, that is, where will these soldiers come from? This morning in this hour, we'll be talking about how it is that the United States will meet its need for military personnel, perhaps both in the short term here, but also into the future. We'll be talking about the logistics of military buildup in Iraq and also beyond. And our guest for the program is Cindy Williams. She's a principal research scientist of the Security Studies Program of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And she, in her work, is interested in a number of things, including how the United States allocates resources among programs that are related to national security, also the reform of military personnel policies. Formerly, before going to MIT, she was an assistant director of the Congressional Budget Office, where she led the National Security Division in studies of budgetary and policy choices related to defense and international security. She is, by her academic training, a mathematician. She has a PhD in mathematics at University of California, Irvine. And she's the editor of two books that touch on the subjects here that we'll be talking about. One is titled Holding the Line, U.S. Defense Alternatives for the Early 21st Century. And the other is Filling the Ranks, Transforming the U.S. Military Personnel System. Both of these books published by the MIT Press, the first one in 2001 and the second in 2004. She is joining us this morning by telephone. She's been good enough to spend some time talking with us this morning. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that they are brief, and we just ask that so that we can get in as many different people as might like to join us and keep our program moving. But certainly, comments and questions from listeners are welcome. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And the call's on us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455, Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Williams, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, right at the beginning, I guess I have to admit, having now read some things here and read a lot of numbers, to being confused, and which is probably my usual state. So what I want to do first is to talk a little bit about the planned, what is called the surge, the troop surge that the president has talked about. And so what he has said that he wants to do is, and I believe the number is, the precise number is 21,500. He wants to send an additional 21,500 troops, and mostly that they, it's my understanding again, that they would be going into Baghdad to deal with security in the city. Now, leaving aside the questions, and certainly many people, including members of Congress, have raised questions about what effect that would have. If we leave that question aside and simply look at the personnel question, is it going to be a difficult thing to find that these 21,500 people? Are they somehow in the system already, in the military already, and it's just a matter of reassignment? Or does this somehow raise the question of actually having to go out and find new people?
David, you've got exactly the right question. And because the president wants to do this immediately, this is part of his immediate plan, there's no way to go find new people, recruit them, bring them in. There's not any way of forming up new units. And so there's really only three ways to get these people. The first is to keep people in place who are already in Iraq, and several units have already been told that's happening to them. In fact, some of them found out from their families that it was happening to them, that they'd be staying an additional 6 months beyond the year that they've already been there. So that's the first way. The second way the president can do it is to take units that got home from Iraq relatively recently, that is within the past year, and send those units right back. So now we're talking about people who are in the active duty force, whose unit came home sometime last year, who were expecting to have at least 2 years off at home, not just for their personal well-being, but also so that the units can reintegrate new people into the units from the, you know, from new recruits, and so that they can get retrained and become cohesive units again. Those units will be going back in less than a year from the time they got home, instead of having 2 full years at home. That's the second way. And then the third way, and there will be some of this as well, is that units that are in the National Guard and Reserve, these are units that had hoped to be home for 5 years before they have to go back, because they, remember, most of them have civilian jobs and thought of themselves as part-timers in the active duty forces. Those people are going to have to go back way before their 5 years at home. So those are the three ways. And, of course, it's going to be stressful on the units themselves, which haven't had time to train or who are already very stressed out from having been in Iraq for a full year. This is going to be hard for the individuals. It's going to be hard for the units.
Mm-hmm. That's, well, there obviously there are two kinds of problems. That's the one I'm sure that you would want to highlight, the fact that these people, they're tired, they're worn out, and they are due for, a lot of them are due for a rest and had expected it, and that's going to be a problem. I'm sure it will be a problem with maintaining their combat effectiveness and a problem with maintaining their morale, even though I'm sure that they're dedicated and they're hardworking people and they'll do their best. Still, when you have people and they're deployed for that long, and perhaps then they have some expectation that they're going to get a break and they're going to get home, and then you tell them, no, sorry, you can't. That is really, really tough.
Well, in fact, there have been some studies, really good studies done by the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, California, about what are the effects of deployment on people's morale and on their intention to stay in the military, which matters too. And what's coming out of those studies is that a person who's deployed one time, it actually boosts his or her morale, because typically it's what they trained for, it's what they joined the military for. They completely expect a deployment, and the units get quite cohesive before they go for the one time and while they're there. So people actually value one opportunity to be deployed. But the biggest problems for people's morale are either an extension in place or multiple deployments. And the absolute worst of all that is when they have uncertainty in their lives. And so people who expected one thing and got another are the individuals and the units that have the lowest morale and the least likelihood to stay in the military as soon as they're allowed out.
Yeah. Well, that's a question at some point I do want to come to, because I think it goes to this larger question of meeting future need, attracting people in the military, those people looking at the experience of people now, it might raise questions in their mind about whether they wanted to be involved in the military at all. But let's set that aside. Let me ask you one other question, just again related to this, and that's the non-personnel side. When you talk about doing something like this, does it pose challenges for the all of the material supply side, making sure that there's enough ammunition and that they have all the vehicles that they need and that they're properly maintained and that they have all of the stuff that they have to do the job?
Well, you know, the military's been running through equipment like nobody's business. And the biggest problem that we've had is that the equipment, a lot of the equipment has actually been sent to Iraq. And so the units that are home, supposed to get trained for next time in Iraq, don't have the equipment that they need to train on. That's really the biggest complaint of the individuals in the units who are turned around so fast to go back to Iraq, is that they don't even have the equipment that they need to train on so that they can turn around. In terms of ammunition, we've been pumping out ammunition like nobody's business, and so we're actually doing quite well in that regard. But, of course, there's been a big cost, the cost of up-armoring the Humvees, the cost of adding body armor for individuals, the costs of the whole logistics train, fuel parts, and so on. Those costs have just skyrocketed in the past 2 years.
Well, let's take another step here. Now, we're saying that if there was this immediate need for increased troop strength, that there is a way to do it by doing the things that you have said, by saying to the people who were already in Iraq and expecting that they'd be able to go home, to say to them, sorry, you've got to stay, to then to take units that were just sent home and send them right back, and then to tighten the break time that Guard and Reserve units have, that they'd been there and that they'd come home. And we've said, well, we promise you there are a certain period of years here we will not call you back. So those things can be done, but there's a limit to how long you can keep doing that. And I think that that there is some big questions about, as we look now into the, we see how thinly stretched we are now. And as we look into the future, if we want to make certain that we have enough people to meet the need for soldiers and in addition, of course, all the support personnel and so forth, that the total number of people in the military, it's going to have to grow. What and that's something the president is talking about, and I'm sure that they're talking about that in the Pentagon. What are people thinking of in terms of the need to actually grow the total size of the military?
Right. This is an interesting question because it really hinges on whether we're still going to be in Iraq a year from now or 2 years from now or 5 or 10 years from now. If the administration had a plan to very much lower the footprint, lower the number of people in Iraq from the 140,000 who are there today down to, say, 50,000, then they wouldn't need any more troops. But if it's true that we're staying in Iraq for years, then they do have to have more troops, or this will continue to happen, that units don't have enough time back home to regroup, and the Guard and Reserve are overused, and that individuals have sort of no time at home with their families. So the Army has always had a goal of being able to have its active duty units go 1 year on and 2 years off. And to get to that 1 year on, 2 year off pattern, and also to get to the pattern that I mentioned for the Guard and Reserve, where they're on 1 year and then they're off for 5 or 6 years, to get to the pattern, they would need about 90,000 more troops than what we started 2001 with. Now, they've already added about 25,000 troops to the active duty Army. So that means they'd need something like 65,000 more from what they actually have in the Army and Marine Corps today. Mm-hmm. And that's what the administration, this is what President Bush announced in his State of the Union address on Tuesday night. He said that he was going to ask Congress for the permanent authority, that means put it into permanent law, that the Army and Marine Corps together can have 92,000 more troops than where they started in 2001. So it's not really 92,000 more than they happen to have today, but it's 92,000 more than people have envisioned as the permanent size of those forces. And that 92,000 would go about 65,000 to the Army and the rest to the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, Iraq has put a significant strain on the military that would not be there otherwise. So perhaps if it had not been for Iraq, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But having said that, I guess I wonder whether you think, and perhaps other people who work in the military in the same area, talking about military planning and military resources, think that in the recent past here, as we have, as the government and the Department of Defense has thought about what it needs, have they underemphasize the, when they think about all the things they need, weapon systems and tanks and planes and guns and everything that goes with it, have they underestimated the need for people?
Well, I would say that the community that looks at these issues, including people inside the military, are of two minds on this right now. And I'll tell you first my preference. I think that we should keep the Army at its current size, that it should be kept relatively small. But that's because I never want to do an Iraq again, right? Mm-hmm. I would much prefer it if citizens of the United States would look at the Iraq experiment and say, this was a big mistake. This is not the foreign policy that the U.S. should be adopting. We shouldn't be looking at toppling governments in other countries and then running those countries for years at a time. And that's the only reason that you need these these increases of force is if we think that we are going to do more Iraqs or we're going to do Iran and actually stay in Iran ourselves, occupying Iran, or take over another country and occupy it for years at a time. If we don't need to do that, if Iraq had ended when the president declared the end of formal combat operations and declared mission accomplished back in May of 2003, if the Iraq war had ended then, there would have been absolutely plenty of troops to do that. If you recall, when we had the Persian Gulf War of 1991, Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, we had about twice as many troops in Kuwait and then in Iraq as we had in the initial combat phase of the current Iraq war. So to have a six-month war is a much different situation from having a four-year war or a five-year war. So I'm on the side that says, no, we shouldn't expand the forces, and the reason is we don't want to do this again. Now, there's another side, and I think surely the Army Chief of Staff feels this way today. The other side says, no, you just can't guarantee that we're never going to do this again, and you can't put the Army in this situation again if we do, as a country, decide to take over a country and stay there for 4 years. So it's crucial, the other side would say, it's crucial that we have these 90,000 extra troops because the Army and the Marine Corps and the Guard and Reserve simply can't continue to hold territory in this way and conduct these stabilizing operations of moderate size for many years without what they call a better rotation base. In other words, enough people that any individual in any unit only has to go every 3 years from the active forces or every 6 or 7 years from the Guard and Reserve.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Cindy Williams. She is a principal research scientist of the Security Studies Program of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And in her work, studies a number of things like military personnel policies, about how it is the government allocates resources to deal with national security matters. And we're talking here about the logistics of a military buildup, both the one that is now under discussion in the relatively short term in Iraq, but also about how people think that we ought to meet our needs and, in fact, what the future needs for the size of the military are. Again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, then that gets it as the question to the question of if indeed the reality is that we think at least for the near future we are going to need these people, and then now we go ahead and proceed with this plan to try to find an additional 92,000 people willing to join the military. Now we have a challenge. I'm sure the military has a challenge because, you know, the question is, how do we persuade these 92,000 people to join? Are we going to have to do something, offer them more than is being offered now? I'm sure that there are people who would be willing to volunteer, motivated by patriotism, by whatever kind of benefits the military will provide, educational benefits and whatever. But 92,000 people, that's a lot of people. And I'm sure that some will look at the experience of those who have served in Iraq and seen how long they've been there and would maybe say, you know, I'm just not going to, I'm willing to go a certain way and yet not that far. What's the military going to do to try to attract these 92,000 people to join up?
Right. That's a really good question, David. And I think it's going to be a real challenge, beyond a challenge. I actually think this is going to be impossible to get these people into the force in the coming five-year period, especially if the Iraq war is going on. Let me just bring you up to, you know, sort of where things stand right now. You probably know that the Army and Marine Corps, like the other services, reduced substantially after the Cold War ended. So between 1990 and 1998, there were big reductions in the size of the force. So it would be wrong to say that the U.S. couldn't sustain a military of a much larger size. We did that during the Cold War. The problem right now is that the Iraq War is putting a very big damper on recruiting on people's willingness to join the military. And even more than the young people's, the individual's decisions to join the military or their preferences to join the military is what's going on with their parents, their teachers, and their coaches. These are people that the military recruiters would call the influencers in young people's lives. And those people are not willing to send their sons, daughters, and students off to the army to fight in Iraq. And in particular, among the black population, which really used to be, to some extent, the backbone of the army, blacks in 2004 or in 2003 made up something like 22%, of the entering class of the military enlisted force. Excuse me one second. But since the Iraq War started, the black participation in the military has gone way down. And so this year's class is down to about 12%, which is consistent with black representation in that age group in the rest of the population. So blacks can't be counted on in the way that they could in the past to join the army and be part of this force. And moreover, in general, the Army's really had a hard go of recruiting. And just to give you an indication of how difficult this has been, the Army has had the authority from Congress to temporarily add up to 30,000 people for several years. And they've only been able to add 25,000 because recruiting has been so difficult for them. So last year, they actually met their recruiting numbers, but their recruiting numbers had been set low enough that they thought they had a chance to meet them. And in fact, to meet those numbers, they had to make enormous trade-offs between quality and quantity. So where they used to be able to bring in more than 90% of their people were high school diploma graduates. Last year, only 80% were high school diploma graduates, where it used to be that the vast majority of their people scored above average on the sort of intelligence test, the test of cognitive aptitude that is the military entrance test. That fraction had declined substantially, and they were even dipping into the population of people who scored in the bottom third of that entrance test. You probably know that they raised the maximum age for entry.
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be that you could join up till the age of 35. Now they have privates who just joined the military who are 42 years old. So just about every little edge they could take in terms of quality, they have been taking.
Well, and in terms of what it is they can promise to people who sign up, obviously one of the difficulties is they can't make promises about how much time you'd be likely to spend in a combat theater of operations, how much time off you're going to get. It seems that's going to be one of the problems for people looking at joining up is that could change from month to month. It seems that there's not much else that they have to offer except perhaps trying to offer increased pay and benefits.
Well, and they have been giving increased pay and benefits. So, of course, pay has gone up, sort of the basic pay level, and the housing conditions and the housing pay has gone up. But perhaps the most important thing is that the bonuses that are available to people in the categories where they specifically need people, and right now it's people in the combat arms, the entry bonuses to those people have doubled. So still true that not everybody gets one, and not everybody gets the $40,000 that's the maximum, but everybody's getting about twice what they would have gotten a few years ago in bonuses. There's also increased bonuses for people who are making a decision whether to stay after their four-year initial commitment is up. So those bonuses, the reenlistment bonuses, have doubled. But there's other things the Army has done, and I'm sure you and your listeners have noticed this. They've very much increased their level of advertising, and they've changed their advertising campaign to reach out to these parents and coaches and influencers more specifically. So there are these ads where it's maybe a father and a daughter or a father and a son having a conversation with the son or daughter saying, look, this is important. It's important to me for personal growth, and it's important to the country, and I think, you know, it's an important job that the Army is doing. So, you know, you need to rethink your way of thinking about my going.
Mm-hmm.
So they are really reaching out to parents in the current advertising campaigns.
The lines here are full of callers, and we'll get right to them in a second. Just if those people won't mind holding them, it's just one further question. I've read something suggesting that there are some people who think that if you take a look at all of the people that are in the military, you ask this question, you say, well, we need as many people as we can get who are capable of carrying a rifle, who are capable of serving in combat. And then you look at all of the people within the military, they'd say that there are people who are doing non-combat kind of jobs who would be actually capable of carrying the rifle and doing that. Is it actually possible we could go to the Pentagon and we could go all around and we could find people who are doing sitting at a desk or doing something else like that. I'm not saying that that's not important, but a non-combat job, and then take that person and give them the rifle and send them into the combat and find somebody else to do the job that they were doing, either a civilian or somebody else who was in the military.
Yes, in fact, that's been going on. I'll just mention something that's going on in the Air Force and the Navy, which you don't think of as doing the infantry work here.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, about 15,000 members of the Air Force and Navy have been shifted over to do Army jobs. They're still wearing their Air Force and their Navy uniforms, but they are in Iraq or Afghanistan, and they're doing Army-type jobs, either military police jobs, or some of them are medics working directly with Army units. Some of them have become civil affairs people in Iraq. And then there are some people who help to do the explosive ordnance detonations, in other words, deal with these IEDs, the improvised explosive devices that the Iraqi insurgents use. So we've already shifted a lot of people who thought they joined to sail the seas or thought they joined to support airplanes, and we've shifted them to be basically soldiers with the Army in Iraq. And, you know, it's getting better now, but initially it was very problematic for those people because they didn't have infantry training. Since 2004 and 2005, when they started doing this, the Air Force and the Navy have both developed new training programs for their people who are going to have to go to Iraq so that they do get some infantry training so that they're not as vulnerable as they were initially. But initially, they were dying in disproportionate numbers because they didn't have the infantry-type skills.
We have as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Cindy Williams. She is a principal research scientist of the Security Studies Program at MIT. And her work there looks at a number of things like how the government allocates resources in programs that involve national security. Also, she's done some study of reform of military personnel policies. Before going to MIT, she was an assistant director of the Congressional Budget Office, where she led the National Security Division in studies of budgetary and policy choices that relate to defense and security. She's the editor of two books, both published by the MIT Press, Holding the Line, U.S. Defense Alternatives for the Early 21st Century, and Filling the Ranks, Transforming the U.S. Military Personnel System. And we have a number of callers here, and we will get right to them and start with somebody on a cell phone and on line one.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes.
I appreciate Dr. Williams' research. I appreciate her dedication to what she's doing. And I especially appreciate the review that you're giving to this on the air at this time. I am one of those people, a parent, a teacher with 35 years experience in secondary level and university, and also a coach. I'm proud to say that my son has elected to and is currently serving in the Air Force. He has a mechanical engineering degree, and he is a pilot serving in the military headed for the Middle East. I would also like to say that instead of talking about parents and teachers and coaches denigrating the military, I think what I have found is that in my professional academe that that particular group has appealed to a sense of citizenship, appealed to responsibilities. And I'm happy to say that where I have taught, the large number of students in the honors as well as the lower in the practical and the vocational fields have, because of the nature of the community of the school, have recognized that military commitment is one form of citizenship. And I would simply like that to be acknowledged. I would like to also say that I appreciate, once again, Dr. Williams' comments regarding her research. I did not particularly appreciate, nor do I feel it was appropriate for her to make a political position statement that was purely hers and a subjective call. Thank you very much.
Well, all right. You can respond to that anytime, any way you like.
Good. Well, thank you for that call. I think that's it's so wonderful to hear that you're involved in a school where there is this emphasis on citizenship and on military service being a rightful obligation of citizenship. You know, since the U.S. adopted the all-volunteer force back in 1973, people have been concerned that we were getting away from that notion. Back until 1973, of course, we had a draft. And with the end of the Vietnam War, the U.S. chose to get rid of the draft and switch to a force in which every single member is a volunteer to serve. And that volunteer force has a lot of good features, and I think the military chiefs love it to death. They're so pleased with the way the all-volunteer force works. But one of the concerns that people do have about an all-volunteer force is that people will forget that military service is an obligation of citizenship and a good thing for citizens to do to express their patriotism and express the importance to them of being citizens. And increasingly, there's a concern that there's kind of a skybox mentality, especially among elites in the United States, that everybody has their support the troops magnets on their cars, but people, especially in the upper income brackets, especially people whose kids are in private schools, are not suggesting that their children choose a military career or even do a four-year stint in the military, either as officers or enlisted folks. And that instead, they're sort of watching the Iraq war unfold as though they're sitting in a skybox and as though it doesn't really have anything to do with them personally. So to hear that a teacher in Champaign-Urbana is really working with young people, coaching them, making them understand that military service is a good thing and a positive part of U.S. citizenship, I think, is very gratifying. I'll mention on the political side, I don't think you can talk about the Iraq war or about our troops without talking about politics. Every decision that's made has a political component to it. And I personally think it's better to sort of get the politics out in the open. I don't, you know, like to be in a situation where you're only fighting about politics, but I think it's important to recognize where people are coming from when they're talking to you about these very heartfelt, very emotional, and very important to the nation types of issues.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I hope she'll forgive me for going on because the lines are full and my clock is ticking down to the end of this hour. So I want to go next and talk with someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'll try to be quick to say initially that I feel the tragedy of the people that go over there and die and are wounded, and the financial, much less important financial blunder that it is that we've gone over there in the first place. but I don't feel especially gratified. I think that the military went there because they could do it. You know, they could conquer Iraq, and I think that the greater political wisdom would have been to elect an administration that would have at least been more intelligent about doing this if they had to do it at all, and maybe would have stopped at Afghanistan, which I think we had a little more right to deal with. But that said, I wonder if you think that going ahead, that if we increase our military, don't you think that like the neocons / Vulcans, one of their arguments was that we have this wonderful military, we can do this, and so there's an impetus because you have the power to exercise the power? And I wonder if you'd address the fact that if we do increase our military, won't we just almost inevitably find another place to use it? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Yes, in fact, that was the point I was making that the previous caller considered political. I do think that I wouldn't want to see us use the military in this way again, and it's why I am opposed to an increase in the overall size of the military, especially a permanent increase in the overall size. I think that if we do have a larger military, we'll find other ways to use it, and they won't be a good idea. So that's exactly the reason why I oppose it. Now, in terms of the sort of blaming the military for being in Iraq, I think that would be the wrong thing to do. This was the decision to go to Iraq, as I understand it, was purely political. And I don't mean low politics. I just mean it was a decision that had to do with President Bush's and his advisors' sense of what was required, and their sense at the time, I think, of what was required to make the nation safe. I personally fault them for that decision, but I do not fault the military, either the individuals who are serving at low levels in the military or even the chiefs of the military at the time. In fact, the Army chief at the time of the invasion of Iraq said that he was very concerned that the Army wasn't big enough and that the force level wasn't large enough for the initial attack in Iraq. And I think it's not clear to me that the Army at all was chomping at the bit, rooting for a war in Iraq. I think Army leaders were very, and generally are, maybe the most conservative, with a small c, the most conservative about the use of force. And they're less likely often than political leaders to want to jump the gun and use force because they have the experience and understand the history of the use of force well enough to know that it's going to be very hard on them.
All right. Again, we'll move on to Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Yes, if you could please have your guest put into perspective the statements of John Kerry when he brought forward the class nature of the military and those who are included and those who can exclude themselves. And I'll ring off. Thank you.
Is the question clear?
Yes, I think so. There is this perception that in the United States, elites generally are not serving in the military, and that if we had a draft that was exercised in the way that our draft system worked in the early 1970s, that we would be better. There's this idea. And the idea is that if we had a lottery system for a draft, then everybody would be potentially having to serve, and you'd get people from every stratum of society. And there is a perception that the lower socioeconomic categories are the ones that are sending their sons and daughters. In fact, when you look at the numbers, it's not quite that way. If you look at the numbers by what's called quintile, in other words, the top 20 percent of in terms of socioeconomic status, then the next 20%, the next 20%, and the bottom 20%. The people who join the military forces are about evenly distributed across those quintiles, which means that people in the top 20% are just as likely to be serving in our all-volunteer forces as the people in the bottom 20 percentile. That doesn't mean still, though, that elites serve if you think elites maybe are the top 10% or the top 2%. So it's still possible that, I mean, we know that the sons of, and daughters of congressmen, by and large, are not serving. We know that the president is not sending his daughters to serve. So we do know, you know, that people in the very top don't tend to send their sons and daughters. And I think that's what John Kerry was talking about.
Well, there are some people who have said that for two reasons, both to meet the needs of the military for personnel and to spread out the burden, if it's okay to use a word like that, among all Americans, that we should be thinking about going back to a system of draft. Now, I suppose some people would say, well, that's just a political non-starter. It ain't going to happen. Do you think that there would be a reason to do that, first of all? And then do you think that politically it would actually be possible?
I have to say I have a different idea, which is that we should have a national test that has one question and only one question, and that is, should we stay in Iraq or should we leave Iraq? And for those who answer we should stay, they should be putting on a uniform or sending their sons and daughters, pure and simple. I think that would sort this Iraq situation out very quickly, because we'd really be putting people to the test. If they think we belong there, then they'd be making their personal contribution to being there. But in terms of do we need a draft, I certainly hope we don't, because I think the all-volunteer force has been the single best enabler of the type of high-tech, capable, incredibly powerful forces that we have today compared with the relatively poor forces that we had in Vietnam. That does not mean that we can't get a wonderful force through a draft, because we had fabulous forces in World War II, but that was a situation where nearly everybody served. So you get a cross-section of society, everybody's involved in it, everybody's kind of helping each other. It's a different situation from the one that we'd have if we adopted a draft today, because even if we wanted to double the size of the U.S. Army, we wouldn't need anything like every young man or every young man and woman who turns 18 each year. Mm-hmm. So I think that when we have an all-volunteer force, since we adopted the all-volunteer force, we've had an incredibly high-quality force. The military has basically been able to pick and choose the people it wants. Now, that's not the case this year, but in general, it's been able to pick and choose the people it wants. The people it gets are ones who want to be there, so there are far fewer discipline problems. There aren't any problems with enforcement, which we would see that again if we return to a draft. Making sure that people fulfilled their obligations, it can be a huge cost and a big burden for society. So for a lot of reasons, I hope that we don't see ourselves headed back in a direction of draft. Now, how it would happen if we did, Congress would have to vote to restore the draft. The system is basically in place. In other words, we have already the selective service system that requires every 18-year-old young man to notify the government of where he is living. And so we have a system in place to call up at least the young men. You know, one thing we'd have to consider as a country if we did restore the draft is whether women would be obliged as well as men.
Yeah. Well, let's see if we can get at least a couple more callers in here in the time that is remaining, and we'll go next to Champaign, line 3. Hello.
What percentage of the military is privatized at this point?
That's a very good question. And, you know, the last figures that I have are about what percentage of people who are in near combat situations in Iraq and Afghanistan are private you know, civilians working for private companies like Blackwater. And the last figure I heard was something like 10% of the U.S. forces in Iraq are actually working under the auspices of private contractors. Typically, these are people who used to be in the U.S. military, got out of the military, and then joined these private contractors. And they're doing all kinds of jobs in Iraq. Some of them are providing security, either for dignitaries or for U.S. political people, for the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Iraq. But many of them are doing other things. They're helping with the reconstruction work, or they are helping U.S. soldiers get through their days, for example, by providing the food services or the laundry services.
Yeah, I don't view this as a good thing, especially if the trend continues. And I understand that they make a huge amount of money, maybe $100,000 a year, and I think the tension between them and the military. So when you want to comment, and I'll just go off the air.
Yes, I think there are some real issues here, and some of them have to do with, you know, who's going to mourn these people when they die? Because, in fact, we did lose some Blackwater contractors this week. And it's a very sad thing, but I think the nation doesn't feel the same way that they do about those people as we do about the individuals who are serving their country in uniform. There is this huge disparity in salary. Typically, the Blackwater people or the individuals who are serving for other private entities are earning on a daily basis vastly more than our soldiers in uniform. And this is, I think, hard for the soldiers to look at. Now, the people who are serving in company uniforms instead of U.S. military uniforms don't have the same retirement system as our men and women in uniform. They don't have the same expectations of a long-term career as our men and women in uniform. So there are a lot of offsets, but I think when you're an individual in the theater looking at somebody making three times as much as you are on a daily basis, it's still a very hard thing.
Next is line one, and this is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. My Air Force son just returned from serving an Army posting. It was his second deployment, and I feel that one of the reasons that we ended up in the situation we're in right now is that such a small percentage of our population is either serving or they have family serving. I'm extremely proud of my son's service to our country, but I feel that we all would have had more ownership of our foreign policy if we had either still had a draft or if we had instituted the policy of universal service, which I think might be a solution to what you're talking about. That is where every high school student would, if they were able-bodied, would serve our country in some capacity, either in some kind of social service sort of situation, serving in the AmeriCorps, the Peace Corps, working in an senior citizen center, working in a child care center, or serving in the military. But they would do some kind of constructive duty to serve our country in some way, every single one. And I think that would counter some of the apathy that a lot of young people seem to feel about our country. And if they work for it, then they would feel some ownership in our country and be more of an active participant as a citizen. So I would like for you to speak to the idea of universal service, if it's even being considered at all. And I'll hang up and listen. I know you don't have much time. Thanks.
Well, bye. Again, thanks for the comment. You have some thoughts about that?
I do. I think universal service has, you know, that thought has some very attractive features. And there are several countries in Europe, you know, most of Europe has been shifting to all-volunteer forces, just like the United States did back in the 1970s. But some countries in Europe still have universal service of the type that the caller describes. People either join the military or they must join another public service agency and do maybe social service work, either driving an ambulance, helping out in nursing homes, and so on. And there's a lot of appeal to that in terms of building a citizenry that really feels connected to the state. There are some drawbacks, too. And, of course, you know, one of the first questions is how would one decide which ones have to go to Iraq and be shot up there and which ones go to the nursing homes, right? In Europe, they've been letting people decide for themselves, by and large, and they're taking in a very much declining share to the military because people are making the decisions themselves. So that's one question. Another question is, what would these social services be, and how would the U.S. pay for them? And then a third question is, do we really want our ambulance drivers to be 18-year-olds who don't want to be there? And so just like with an all-military draft, there's a question about enforcement. How do you get the people to work ably and sort of in a good spirit for the year or two or three that they're in this kind of service? How do you get them to do that if they don't want to be there? So those are just some questions, but I share the caller's interest in thinking about ways that we could bring our young people to be more active in their role as citizens.
We've come to the time where we have to stop here for this hour, and I'm sure there are a lot of things that we have a lot of possibilities here, I think, for future programs, other things that we could talk about. For the moment, though, we're going to have to leave it there with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Cindy Williams. She's Principal Research Scientist of the Security Studies Program of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's the editor of two books that deal with these issues. If you're interested, they're both published by the MIT Press. One is Holding the Line, U.S. Defense Alternatives for the 21st Century. The other is Filling the Ranks, Transforming the U.S. Military Personnel System. And Dr. Williams, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, David. It was my pleasure.